This week, investors chose the sidelines ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek here. Another big show and two more top industry guests on this April 27th episode. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto? It sounds eerily similar, doesn't it, to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged with Who is John Galt? I investigate just who might be Satoshi Nakamoto. So just who is Satoshi Nakamoto? New evidence indicates and handwriting analysis suggests that it's Nick Szabo. That's right, the cryptographer and well-known computer wizard Nick Szabo. He created BitGold about 10 years ahead of Bitcoin, which also has very similar characteristics in its platform and other aspects. His background also fits with computer science and legal background, which would help with cryptography. And besides, if you were a professional cryptographer, an original cypherpunk, wouldn't you want your friends and colleagues with similar, you know, technical backgrounds to figure out that you created Bitcoin while everyone else was stumped? So here's my elementary level attempt to help resolve it with all the mountain of other evidence. First, we reverse the order of Satoshi Nakamoto to Nakamoto Satoshi. Yes, I believe he may have hidden his name, or they may have hidden his name, in the nom de plume, Satoshi Nakamoto. I think this is a pseudonym for Nick Szabo. Second step, we shorten the names Nakamoto Satoshi to Nak Sato. Sound familiar? Nick Szabo. All right, I admit it's a leap. It takes a step. So my first hypothesis is to protect against legal issues, he used the pseudonym, or they used the pseudonym, as sort of a smokescreen, if you will, and left the approximately 1 million bitcoins that were earmarked for Satoshi right on the blockchain. Okay, so that's your smokescreen, if you will. He probably mined another huge amount of Bitcoin. Maybe it was a million, maybe not, way back in 2009. You remember when it was launched, I think January 2009. Difficulty was virtually null. You could clear a whole block and I think receive 50 Bitcoins in just an afternoon worth of desktop computer mining. So I'd like to hear your thoughts. Am I way off base on this, or do you think we might have identified who must be one of the most wealthy Bitcoin hodlers in history? The only question is, would he have now the cojones to actually claim those remaining 1 million bitcoins? And could he sell them without really damaging the market? Who knows? So joining me with his take on the crypto phenomenon, of course, Bix Weir, Road to Ruta returns. He says blockchain will exceed almost everyone's imagination. It's difficult to explain email to somebody who's never seen, heard, or used email relative to snail mail. You know, you just have to use the technology sometimes to understand it and appreciate it. Plus, we start part one of the digital collectibles mania. I think we could be on the cusp of perhaps a $10 billion market. It all started off with crypto. CryptoKitties, yes, we know that's a Beanie Baby sounding. But what's interesting is the technology, as always. And this is Ethereum-based ERC-721 tokens. The protocol is different from our typical ERC-20 Ethereum because, unlike Bitcoin and Ethereum tokens, which are fungible, these are non-fungible, which means they can't be exchanged for one another. So we think that that really yields a unique asset potential here. And we're seeing things take off. I mean, just in the last year, cyberpunks, these tiny little images, are now regularly trading from $40 to $100 each, thousands of them created out of thin air. So is it setting up a new tulip mania? Is there something more solid here? Chris Powell from Gata returns from a speaking tour in Hong Kong and Singapore, which includes CNBC and Bullion Star. He has more intriguing research on what he sees as manipulation of the precious metals markets that may result in a global currency revaluation. And Robert Ian drops in with another must-hear report. Remember to call in our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 51, 40, 49, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And don't forget to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter with the alpha boosting candidates for your portfolio. Each week, a new group of stocks, usually with two or three precious metals candidates. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals sector on easing tensions between North and South Korea, which temporarily lowered demand for safe haven assets. Nevertheless, signs of domestic inflation did help keep the leading inflation safe haven within a narrow trading range, which shed only $15. The yellow metal gave back 1%, finishing at 1323 and holding firmly above support. AG gave back a bit more, off 4% roughly, 67 cents, closing at 16.50, while the XAU precious metal shares were off only 2, finishing at support at 83. Black gold finished, though, near the break-even point, bucking the downward trend at $68, near last week's multi-year record high and well above support. The current consolidation forecast suggests a price move to at least $70 in the months ahead. The Bitcoin ETF, though, GBTC, Bitcoin Investment Trust, added 65 cents, about 4%, finishing at 1550 as the sector spent its third week rebounding from recent lows. The top story moving the markets this week included Korean peace efforts and better than expected domestic gross domestic product. Reports indicated a key meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. This was a historic first, resulting in a peace treaty with, quote, complete denuclearization on the table of the Korean Peninsula. The easing tensions ahead of the scheduled meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump was viewed as a big positive and a first. The news took some of the wind out of the safe haven trade, returning money flows to the greenback and U.S. shares. Turning to the domestic economy, the reading on the gross domestic product in the first quarter suggested the world's economy expanded at an annualized pace of 2.3%, that according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, down slightly from 2.9% in the final quarter of 2017, and lower than economists' estimates. Plus, news that the yield of the 10-year Treasury had climbed to the highest, briefly touching above that key 3% level, suggested more signs of higher prices and inflation. So it's little surprise that Fed policymakers will ratchet up the overnight lending rate at the June FOMC meeting, not this next week's two-day policy meeting starting on this Tuesday. We see about a 100% probability they'll hold rates at 1.75% and then in June bump it up. According to the Fed Funds futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group, we'll see a quarter point rate hike at the June meeting, bumping us up to 2%, about 93% odds. Moving on, the positive side of this week's economic numbers included durable goods numbers, which jumped last month. Well, weekly jobless benefits stayed at multi-decade lows. On the less positive side, the cold trade war and related tariff issues continue to plague the markets, keeping some traders on edge, with key industrial players in the EU bracing for tariffs on steel and aluminum scheduled for May 1st. Some attention was focused on the prospect of U.S. redeploying some sanctions also on Iran. Precious metals, bottom line, and Bitcoin. Well, clearly, the U.S. dollar was due for a bounce. It came to pass, put some downward pressure on our favorite sector. Still, the global trade tariff war continues to simmer just under the surface, which will likely turn investors' focus back to trade talks in Beijing, slated for next week with the U.S. and China. The technical picture remains robust, with precious metals and XAU indexes holding up well, and gold still solidly near recent highs. Looks like a coiled spring. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors bought up discounted U.S. shares ahead of next week's FOMC meeting, expected to be relatively uneventful. Plus, better than anticipated U.S. economic numbers suggest that the economy might not be entering the recession projected by some analysts. All big positives for the indices. By Friday's close, the three key indices returned to nearly break even after testing lows earlier in the week. The Dow was off just 151, still holding holding above the key 24,000 psychological support level at 24,311. The S&P 500 bit break-even, 26.69, while the NASDAQ was off just less than 0.5%, 26 points at 71.19. Turning to individual shares in the news, the first quarter earnings season results included solid news from the two largest gold producers, Barrick Gold, ticker ABX, and Newmont Mining, ticker NEM. According to one media source, both of these miners comprise about one-fifth of the holdings within the precious metal shares GDX index. Barrick met analyst expectations while Newmont topped expectations, leading Newmont shares to a fresh 52-week high and a multi-year high close. However, the technical outlook suggests ABX might be a relative valuation, which could lead to better prices ahead. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, as forecasted in the last report, U.S. equities indexes did retest support and rebounded sharp. Our favorite USA Today 7 indicator greed to fear index pendulum also rebounded somewhat from extreme fear levels, leaving still plenty of upside for higher prices. So it really looks like the calls of so many top analysts for the
end of the stock bull market
seems unlikely at this point. I see blue skies, nothing but blue skies. More Gold Seek after this. Welcome, Vic Swear.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you. And you know, people just can't seem to get their minds around the idea of this cipher revolution we're having. They want to try to compare it to email circa 1995, the internet circa 1998-99. What stage of this revolution do you see?
Well, I think obviously we're in the very, very beginning stages, because most people are not involved. Email is a decent comparison. Internet's a decent comparison. But all of that revolved around the continuation of the old corrupt monetary system. The monetary system is the lifeblood of any business, economy, you name it, on planet Earth for the past, you know, hundreds of years. So this is a much, 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 much bigger thing. But it is also Bitcoin, the cryptocurrencies, the blockchain. It's much more than just a currency. It can do more than replace money. It can replace all sorts of costly functions that we employ in any business these days. The banks are drooling on the blockchain because they can cut out 30-40% of their costs. It is an amazing revolution that's happening, that if anybody takes a just slightly bigger picture look at things, can see that it does feel like the internet in 1990. It feels like the very beginning days of email, when people like Katie Couric were saying, who could send mail? Who wants to get mail on the internet when you have a post office box? We're getting those kinds of comments from people who are supposed to know what they're talking about. They're calling Bitcoin, they're calling it a scam, they're calling it a bubble. It's all normal and part of something that's just beginning, but it's going to be so big, it's going to blow out anything that humanity has ever seen as far as innovation.
My latest trek or endeavor into this space involves crypto collectibles. And at first, I just cringed. I couldn't even stand the thought of another Beanie Baby. The more you look into this, the more you start to realize that there is a potentially multi-billion dollar industry that's just growing out of, I don't know if it's really demand or the need for it. It seems to be more the technology that's driving this whole new collectibles, crypto assets. Because assets is something I think that most people can get a little more excited about. The one that caught collectors' attention was CryptoKitties. And I know this audience is just thinking, you've gone off the deep end. What is our host talking about here? CryptoKitties? If you can ignore the moniker for a minute and just look at the technology, the idea is profound. You have this game, if you will, where you can breed these different crypto-related cats on the Solidity language. Each of these individual contracts has its own DNA, its own probability factors and whatnot. And where it really took off and led to a $250,000 individual creature, it's just like the Tulip Mania. Certain characteristics that were in high demand. As that grew and grew, it created its own sort of supply demand that led this whole thing off the charts to a multi-million dollar industry. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not this is the beginning of a crypto asset revolution, or was that just a flash in the pan?
I think it's a little of both. The crypto kitty part of it, yeah, it is a lot like the Beanie Baby stuff, but the technology behind it was what was really intriguing, and it can be applied to so many other things. It's basically using the blockchain to do various things, such as a proof of ownership, proof of creation, the division of ownership, a timestamp that you can absolutely nail down who created this thing, when and where. It's the ultimate certification. There's all kinds of things associated. And it just happened to be linked to CryptoKitty, which, you know, is a Beanie Baby type of fad thing that will go away, obviously. But, and then everybody got locked into it because it was going up in price and people chased price. But when you look behind it, it really does have an amazing use case for the blockchain, because the blockchain is immutable. You can't change it, and it has a timestamp. You can attach things to it that can prove things. That's the key to the blockchain. It's a truth machine, and it's a proof machine. So you can say, I own this specific asset, or I created this piece of artwork at this time, at this moment, kiss all the necessary certifications for copyright and all that right out the window, because you have something that can prove that you were the first one to bring this into existence, certify ownership. It's really an amazing concept. The CryptoKitty part is kind of a separate thing. That is a bubbly Beanie Baby type of phenomenon, but the thing behind it is the use of the blockchain in that type of environment.
On the show, The Kaiser Report, Max and Stacy point out one of the biggest wrong turns early on was that the developers, you know, decided to call it Bitcoin, ICOs, initial coin offering, as though they were tempting regulators. Because in reality, it's not a coin. It does have fungibility aspects of a coin. Maybe that's a good segue into the next topic here on this. I'm calling it a digital collectibles mania. It's a little unfortunate that it had to start with CryptoKitties. You know, why couldn't it have started off with crypto coins like crypto numismatics, crypto AI, this idea of fungibility? We have these ERC protocols. Most people by now have heard of the ERC-20, and that's the typical fungible, meaning exchangeable. So let's backtrack a little bit, circle around, and talk about fungibility. We all know that a dollar is exchangeable for a dollar. That's fungible. A Bitcoin, one Satoshi of a Bitcoin is exchangeable for another Bitcoin Satoshi. And with Ethereum, I think it's called a WEI, although I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, WEI. That's the smallest increment of an Ethereum. Well, it is also fungible, meaning exchangeable. This unbelievable individual by the name of Vitalik Buterin, Russian-born Canadian, I believe. And just a little side note here, to give people an idea of the type of minds behind this revolution, which I actually believe will eventually be revealed, there are AIs, sentient AIs involved. Vitalik Buterin's IQ actually tested to be as high as 256. So ERC-20, this is just the protocol of fungibility. This brilliant individual came up with another protocol, ERC-721, and there are many others. This is the non-fungible protocol, if you will, or algorithm that just simply allows us to trade Ethereum contract as though it's an asset that has this non-fungible quality. Can you talk to this and how it could be essential to this new component of the digital cipher revolution?
I think the biggest thing that comes out of Ethereum and Vitalik and that whole world is that company and the token and the blockchain for Ethereum will continually change and adapt. So anybody thinking that they are inventing or they're investing in a Ethereum killer is really smoking a pipe dream, if you ask. Vitalik will always be 10 steps ahead. And the developers there see what's coming down the pike. The moment they hear, oh, this company has a good idea that's going to beat what you do, they're instantly already working on an idea to make it 10 times better. So it really is, in that world, where smaller contracts are involved and the ERC 20 tokens as businesses being created on top of a blockchain. That will continually evolve, continually change. And as soon as you think a new technology is going to take out Ethereum, Ethereum's going to blow by it and vice versa. So that's the beauty of a free market in this type of world that is just beginning, is that it really pushes Ethereum to do more. It pushes EOS to do more. It pushes other people challenging that space to do more. And then once they feel comfortable, that's when you start losing, because you can never feel comfortable in that space, because it really is an evolving technology. It's an evolving business platform that has to continue to change, continue to evolve. So yes, I think, you know, the ERC 721 tokens and the ERC 20 tokens and all that stuff, innovation each time it leapfrogs other attempts at, you know, out innovating it. So yeah, it's exciting. I love the fact that Vitalik and his group of programmers, which are amazing guys, supposedly, I haven't met any of them, but they're always thinking, you know, 20 steps ahead. Who's going to take us out as the leader? And then what can we do to get 20 times ahead of them again? So I think that's what's happening right now. For example, with EOS coming on to, I think they have a big moment this summer, but it's an untested technology and it's bound to have as many problems or more than Ethereum had at the beginning. So people really need to stand back and say, okay, which technologies are working, which are doing well, which are kind of, you know, hopes to beat the ongoing standards. And then what is the ongoing standard going to do to beat the new guy? So it makes investing hard, because you're going to see just flows of money sloshing one way and the other. I think we're seeing that in Ethereum and EOS.
Let's talk again in 2018.
Sounds good.
Pleasure to welcome back Chris Powell, who's just back from a whirlwind tour, you might say, and maybe you'd like to start off there today.
I spoke at a conference in Singapore and the Minds and Money Asia conference in Hong Kong, and I tried to update them over the last year of developments and gold price suppression. I can't say that I find the monetary metals mining industry very interested in the details of how the price of its products is suppressed, but we keep trying to interest them. I did get on CNBC in Hong Kong for about 5 minutes one Monday morning, and I got interviewed by Bullion Star in Singapore, which was, those two interviews were probably worth haranguing the mining industry.
Interesting development you noted before the show with the BIS. It's the Bank of International Settlements, and you have some rather interesting findings for precious metals aficionados.
Our consultant, the BIS, Robert Lamborn, retired businessman in Britain, has been following the BIS for some years now, and he has noted that the BIS has returned to the gold swap and gold derivatives business sensationally over the last year and a half. The BIS has gone from a zero position in gold swaps and derivatives to a position of more than 500, sometimes almost 600 tons of gold swaps that they have arranged, presumably for their clients, their members, their other central banks. This suggests sudden interest by central banks in the gold market. It also suggests a certain supply shortage in the gold market, inducing the BIS to move gold and gold claims around to be applied to the market to control the price, to keep the price from getting out of control. A few months ago, I wrote to the BIS press office about Lamborn's findings, which are based on the BIS's own monthly and annual reports. I asked the BIS, has Lamborn got it right here? Has the bank turned to the gold swap and derivatives business in a big way? And has he got the numbers right? And Could you tell me what is the purpose of your activity in the gold swaps and derivatives, and on whose behalf is this undertaken? I got a reply from the BIS, I think within 24 hours, telling me they don't talk about this stuff, and you know, you can get more information in our reports, and you get more information from central banks, which is nonsense. There's no more substantial information about gold in the BIS's monthly or annual reports. If there was, I wouldn't have been asking them about it, and you can't get serious information about gold from any central bank. So we know that there is vast new activity in the gold market by the BIS on behalf of its central bank members. We know that because this is reported in the monthly notes. They try to obscure this as best they can. But what does it mean exactly? They will not tell us what it means exactly, which I think is a pretty good indication that it is not innocent activity, that it's very sensitive activity. It's market manipulation activity that cannot be talked about without undermining the whole purpose of the activity. Not conspiracy theory. This is all reports of the BIS, which you can find on their internet site if you know where to look. Have the courage to ask. You can get the door slammed in your face, too. Unfortunately, the mainstream financial news media will not do this work, and even those who present themselves as analysts of the gold market will not look into this and will not ask questions about it.
You know, it's hard to ask questions of a organization which is defiant on offering any answers.
If the Financial Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post or Reuters or Bloomberg, any of those major financial news organizations put questions to the BIS, BIS would feel much more compelled to answer. And if the BIS did not answer, there would be a penalty if the normal rules of journalism were followed, because the news organization would publish a prominent story saying that BIS will not answer the following questions about its activity in the gold market. I've felt for some years now that the greatest power of central banking around the world is not the power of infinite money creation, as you know, big a power as that is. I think the biggest power of central banking in the world right now is the complicity of the mainstream financial news organizations.
And not to mention this subterfuge and obfuscation of the truth, I think is at the heart of this push, this incredible groundswell of decentralization. Of course, that's a topic for a very different show, but the entire crypto movement is decentralizing. I think a better term is disrupting any place where there is non-productivity issues of inefficiency, primarily in the banking sector and in the financial industry, which is why I think they're shaking in their boots as this movement gains momentum. But again, veered way off topic. Anything else you'd like to discuss that you were sharing on your tour of Asia?
Well, I think the second big development, the gold price suppression scheme over the last year, has been the explosion of new way of filling delivery of COMEX gold and silver futures contracts. There's something called the exchange for physicals procedure on the COMEX. It used to be described as an emergency procedure whereby buyer and seller of a futures contract could agree to take delivery of the contract off the exchange if there was a credible promise of delivery of real metal elsewhere, and the contract would be liquidated that way, and the exchange would be relieved of its responsibility for delivery. This used to be an emergency procedure, hardly ever used. In the last year or so, it seems that exchange for physical procedures have taken over the bulk of delivery claims for gold and silver on the COMEX. The suggestion here, there is not enough gold and silver available for delivery in COMEX vaults, and that delivery has to be transferred elsewhere, presumably to London and the totally opaque London Bullion Market Association system. Our consultant, Harvey Organ, has asked the Commodity Futures Trading Commission what's going on here, and has gotten only obfuscation from the CFTC, but something huge has changed, something that used to be described as an emergency procedure for delivering against COMEX gold and silver contracts is now the common procedure. Something very big is up here. It does imply a supply shortage. I think it also implies the involvement of the government in concealing it. We don't know exactly, but again, this is another aspect of the market that cries out for financial journalism. We've informed all the major financial news organizations about it, and of course they haven't picked up on it, I think for the same reasons. But there are big changes underway in the gold and silver futures market, and presumably the real metals market as well. We're not fully informed about them, but we can see the evidence of them and what they're hiding behind. I'd like to think that they herald some changes in the price down the road.
Clearly, I know there will be the listener out there, a lot of very sharp folks listening to our voices, who will think the GATA folks have been, you know, chasing at the heels of these people, these manipulators, for, well, the better part of two decades at least. Market forces should start to reflect that fact. We have the Shanghai Gold Index, and now we have the, you know, yuan-backed oil contract trading for the first time ever, and it has a gold backing there. So the yuan oil or petroleum contract with a gold backing. With these new developments, when will we see the market forces reflect the manipulation schemes that are clearly going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I wish I knew, Chris. I think it is. The answer is largely a matter of how much real metal remains in the hands of the central banks that are participating in the scheme, and I think all major central banks, including China's, are participating in it. It depends on how much real metal that they still control and how much real metal they are ready to lose until they call the scheme off. That is the zillion-dollar question. I don't have the answer to it. I think, you know, within the lifetimes of some people who are now alive, we will see a revaluation of the monetary metals and a concurrent revaluation of the currencies. I mean, there's a currency war is raging all around the world right now. Strange thing happened this week where President Trump accused Russia and China of devaluing their currencies when their currencies have been going up against the dollar. It's the dollar that's been devalued. But there's a currency war going on right now. How it will be resolved is, you know, probably the biggest matter of geopolitical world strategy that's going. But when will it happen? I don't know. I try not to offer people a lot of hope here. I am always reminded of George Orwell's vision of the future in 1984, where totalitarians tells Winston Smith, if you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. I think that is the logic of modern central banking. Even if they do run out of gold and are forced into some sort of revaluation, as they were at 71, and the Plaza Accords, I guess, what was it, 84, 86, you know, that doesn't mean that gold and silver investors are going to reap their deserved benefits. You know, you could have windfall profits taxes on monetary metals. You could have confiscations. I don't know how totalitarian governments will become. I think all GATA can do is try to expose the facts and clamor against deception and in the markets. Try to work toward restoring free markets and transparency and, you know, democracy and truth, justice in the American way. An enormous struggle. And if you want to bet your savings on it, you know, wish you luck. I know I've bet mine. But will we, you know, see the day of deliverance? I don't know. I've had many friends who were far more expert in this field than I, and who saw things much more clearly than I do, and who have died and never saw the reward they were entitled to. I don't know. Not an investment advisor. God is not an investment advisor. We're a nonprofit civil rights and educational organization. I think we are on to the most important political and economic issue in the world that really involves the value of all capital, labor, goods, and services in the world, which is, you know, pretty much everything. But the power we are up against is not going to give up easily. And it may not give up even when it's exposed. Very limited amount of what GATA can do here. The logic of our work is that there is a huge unfillable short position in the monetary metals as a result of central bank creation of gold and silver credits against metal that doesn't exist. I mean, the logic of that is that the monetary metals are spectacularly undervalued. But will governments permit that value ever to be realized? I don't know. They may permit it if it serves their purposes in a worldwide currency revaluation. They may not permit it even then.
No, it's a very Orwellian-like scenario you've outlined here, and I think that, you know, the key player there, Winston, would feel very much at home today in these markets. Orwell's probably doing backflips, as are, I guess, the characters from Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged as well. So just playing out in real time. And will the powers that be, will the big players, will the policymakers actually let free markets, let the invisible hand that Adam Smith wrote about come back into play here? I mean, will we see these markets break free from the shackles of the manipulators? And that's what we're all sort of waiting for. We're starting to see technical signs of that, as your colleague Bill Murphy has done a great job outlining here on the show for years, but it's really starting to build up some momentum. So, you know, maybe as we're starting to lose our enthusiasm about the time the markets start to exceed our expectations.
If enthusiasm and sentiment in the monetary metals sector, Chris, ever meant anything, Bill and I would have gladly committed suicide, and you know, the metals would have gone to the moon right now. But I think you're right. The immediate cost of this system is the destruction of markets everywhere, the destruction of free markets. And if you believe, as we in GATA do, that free markets are the great engines of human progress and democracy, then the destruction of free markets is a catastrophe.
It's going to veer me off topic for just a few moments, but we believe, who are, you know, huge gold and precious metals aficionados, also believers in the crypto movement. The Bitcoin phenomenon, Ethereum, and the others are actually paving the way for the precious metals, because as a decentralized force that is highly resistant to government intervention and things of that nature, these protocols, or assets, if you will, are doing their best to reflect the hyperinflation that we think is simmering just below the surface, that's been held back by the central bankers in particular for so long. We're hopeful, again, we don't know the future, that that will spill over into the physical markets, gold and silver bullion, which then will, of course, overthrow the manipulation in the paper market.
If cryptocurrencies continue having some success, governments will stamp them out as best they can. Governments cannot abide competition in money. Money is how they control the world. They control money. And if there are competitive forms of money, whether they are the monetary metals or cryptocurrencies, governments are threatened by that. If there are ways that ordinary people can opt out of government-controlled financial systems, governments lose power. That's, you know, simply the way it is. It's us or them. If there's ever freedom of currencies, governments will be, you know, much less powerful than they are right now. I think this has been admitted. I think even President Roosevelt admitted this in explaining to people the confiscation in gold that he arranged. He talked about the supreme importance to government of control over the monetary system. Governments control the world by issuing money. If there are other issuers of money, say, you know, the mining industry through the monetary metals or cryptocurrency creators, then, you know, your word is decentralized. Well, you've got much more than a decentralized system. All of a sudden, you've got a democratic system. Anybody can issue his own money, and anybody can give it any value he wants to give. I mean, that's a democratic and even libertarian world. Do you think governments are going to stand for that?
They're having a little more of adoptive attitude, similar to email circa 1994, 1995, where, you know, it was only the bad actors who had access to the internet and email. I think we could still be in the early adopter phase. And whether or not they can wipe it out, well, again, that's one of the neater aspects of cryptography, is it's highly resistant. You can't just walk into Google headquarters or the YouTube headquarters, right, and march out the CEOs who shouldn't have done this or that or the other, because it's highly decentralized. And I think you might agree, for the first time in world history, there is the potential for a global decentralized currency where everyone has access to it. It might be a person who just found an iPhone or an Android, you know, on the streets of Calcutta or, you know, Venezuela, where there's a huge currency crisis right now, and there's a small miner who has free access to electricity. So again, in the West, I think this is less of a big issue for us because we have access to the banking, we have access to financial services, we have brokerage access at almost every level of society. But for the third world and even some of the BRICS nations, this will be, I think, a godsend. Keep in mind, this is an early movement here. You could say Satoshi Nakamoto, whomever that is, maybe it was Hal Finney, that's another debate. It was created 2008, didn't really catch any steam till 2010, 2011 when I started mining. The idea here is pretty sound, though, because it goes back to the cypherpunks of the 80s and 90s who really wanted to have freedom. We had a few attempts at that, and Tim Draper, you know, the billionaire VC Silicon Valley, who has pointed out, look, you know, we only have about a $3 billion crypto market now. It's tiny. It's fractional. I mean, look, the gold market is $7, $8 trillion. We really have exponential growth ahead. And I think when we start to rival the gold market in size, you're right, regulators will say, wait a minute, wait a minute. We have a real viable threat. My hope is, at that point, it will be too late. The genie out of the bottle. The regulators, policymakers will have very little choice but to adopt some type of blockchain-backed system of their own. I mean, it's probably inevitable. You know, we're dealing with clunky pocket knife currency with the greenback right now relative to the decked out Swiss Army knife of cryptos. That's really what's on the horizon. But you really brought up something interesting in the pre-talk, JP Morgan, that they have approximately 134 million ounces of silver in their company stockpile. And we know that they've been heavily involved in the markets, manipulating price. It's documented. Give us an idea of whether or not you agree with Ted Butler's analysis in this area.
Ted has determined that J.P. Morgan Chase has a huge physical silver stockpile that has been developing over recent years. He believes Morgan is controlling the silver price of the in the futures markets. I'm not in a position to argue with him, but I do disagree with Ted as to what's really behind this. I think Ted is very reluctant to concede the possibility that Morgan is not acting for itself, but rather for clients. And we know a few years ago, Blythe Masters, who was then running the commodity desk for Morgan Chase, went on CNBC and echoed a statement that Jamie Dimon had made that Morgan Chase has no position of its own in the monetary metals markets, that the only positions that Morgan had were client positions. Now, unfortunately, nobody asked Morgan Chase, well, who are the clients that you're running these gold and silver accounts for? I would argue, as you know, Morgan is a primary dealer in U.S. government securities and often has acted officially at the behest of the Federal Reserve and Treasury Department during financial crises, that it's immensely unlikely that Morgan would be playing so heavily in a market as sensitive as the monetary metals market if it was not doing so at the behest of the U.S. government or another government that had the approval of the U.S. government. Now, I don't necessarily believe anything Morgan Chase says, but Morgan Chase did insist a few years ago it had no position of its own in the monetary metals, that it was just managing client positions. That being the case, I imagine that Morgan is managing government positions in the monetary metals to help keep the monetary metals under control. Maybe that position is a U.S. government position. Maybe it's a position for the Chinese government. The U.S. government is allowing Morgan to run. I think it's exceedingly unlikely that Morgan would be playing so heavily in such a sensitive market without the express approval of the United States government.
The other argument that we've heard throughout the blogosphere and within the precious metals community is just what might they do with all of that bullion? I mean, is it there as a potential threat? I'm sure you read that the president of Russia, Putin, just started stockpiling silver in their coffers.
Well, it's a monetary metal. Silver, over the course of history, was more common, the monetary metal, than gold. It's, you know, more available in the Earth's crust and more available for use as money, lesser value than gold. It also is an immensely strategic metal, more so than gold, because it has some wonderful industrial and even medical uses.
Didn't we have a 3 billion ounce strategic stockpile, which was eventually entirely sold off? Some of the nuclear enrichment programs in Tennessee, as well as the Southwest United States, but also for the Silver Eagle sale.
The United States demonetized silver from its coinage back in 1965. President Johnson issued a signing statement when he signed the demonetization bill, explicitly warned investors and speculators not to buy silver in expectation that the price would rise as a result of demonetization, because the United States, the president said, would dishoard metal as necessary to control the price and keep the price down. Now, this is an official statement by the president of the United States in 1965, saying the government was prepared to use its silver stockpile for price control. Now, you know, it's only self-evident that the government was using dishoarding from its gold reserves to keep the price down, and doing that in the open right through the London gold pool in 1968, you know, only to be expected. But government was using dishoarding to control not just the gold price, but to control the silver price as well. And, you know, we thought that the silver stockpile was exhausted decades ago, but you know, now Morgan seems to be amassing one through the COMEX. To whom does it really belong? Does it belong to Morgan? I doubt it. Does it belong to the United States government or the Chinese government? I think that's far more likely.
You talk about the potential for a big disruption within the community as the truth about true stockpiles, if you will, in central bank coffers becomes known. Do you see a point, a watershed moment, if you will, where our officials bring their information above board?
Well, there are currency revaluations, international currency revaluations by agreement. Every 25, 30 years or so, I think we are due for one. I rather expect that if the real metal available to central banks is running low, that central banks will have to get ahead of a short squeeze by revaluing the monetary metals. That they will probably do it by announcement on a Sunday night before the Asian markets open, saying that, you know, they're going to be buyers of gold and or silver and, you know, their own currencies at certain preset levels, and that, you know, this will be another currency revaluation. I think they will need higher gold and silver prices in order to maintain the gold and silver price control scheme at more manageable levels. I don't think these prices can be sustained much longer, but, you know, I don't know what it's a lot of this going to be determined by how people react, by how the markets react. People and the markets could change things tomorrow if they wanted to buy enough real metal and take it out of the banking system.
The irony of your statement is less than half of America has $1,000 in savings, but 70-75% claim to have less than $500 of a cushion in the event of an emergency. I think the real question mark then becomes, how will John Q. Public, how will the typical everyday homme moyen procure any metals, even if they want to?
The day of the revaluation will be, you know, too late. Others will have already gotten it. But all I meant to say was that individuals can hasten the day simply by buying metal and taking it out of the banking system, not buying paper. I saw a story on, I think, Bloomberg yesterday about some fund manager thought that gold is now the only safe haven, and that he was moving his investments out of equities and into gold. But what was he doing? He was buying exchange-traded funds. Well, if you're buying GLD, it's just paper. Not only not just paper, it's also paper that's used to hit the market as necessary, keep the price down. I mean, if you're going to buy metal that's really just paper and that is in the control of the manipulators, you might as well flush your money down the toilet. But investor can hasten the day by buying metal and taking it out of the system. That will hasten the day when central banks have to revalue the metals, revalue their currencies, and let free markets resume to a certain extent assessing value around the world. But when will this day come? I don't know.
Chris Powell, giving us a lot of cuisine for cogitation, let's say, today. As we wrap up, any closing thoughts you think the listeners...
Well, I always encourage people to check us out at our internet site, gata.org. Typically put out several email dispatches every day. People can enroll to receive those. They just go to our internet site and sign up on the right column of the... I think I said, we're a nonprofit, federally tax-exempt educational civil rights organization in the United States, and we function entirely by donations, and we're not getting any from Newmont Mining or Barrick Gold or any of those big guys. We do get some money from ordinary investors. We do have a few friends who help us out from time to time, but we can always use donations to support our research and consultants and travel, and to keep clamoring for whatever good it does. And we mean to stick with it. Thanks very much, Chris.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. An article this week in the Washington Examiner discussed the challenges faced by the credit reporting giant Equifax as it tries to repair its situation following the 2017 cyber attack that exposed personal information for nearly half the country and led to a change in company management, all of which has sparked discussion among legislators who may now be considering structural changes in how consumer credit is administered in the U.S. Since disclosing the theft of data, which included birth dates and social security numbers for more than 140 million people in September of 2017, Equifax has lost 19% of its market value. Congressional hearings that followed this breach of both data and public confidence examined some very poignant questions. Namely, who actually owns the data that such companies collect? Is it consumers or credit bureaus? How that question gets answered as events unfold will likely transform the very industry that tracks consumers' payment histories without their consent, pays them nothing for the data, and turns a profit from selling it to lenders. So the real question is, will Congress restrict how credit reporting bureaus like Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian gather and sell your information? Privacy concerns have entered the spotlight and remain center stage, as evidenced by the recent congressional inquiry of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Jarrett Seiberg, a Cowen Washington Research Group analyst, says the market is underappreciating just how frustrated Democrats and Republicans are over big data, which means they could turn to radical ideas for credit bureau reform. Already this year, a banking regulation bill passed by the Senate gives consumers an unlimited ability to freeze and unfreeze their credit reports, and also excludes some medical debt for veterans. It's estimated there is a 70% chance of follow-up legislation in the coming years that might expand consumer control over credit reports, with mandates like free monitoring of credit scores and the requirement for consumer approval before credit histories are shared for marketing purposes. It has been speculated that reforming the Fair Credit Reporting Act could include such things as allowing consumers more latitude to dictate how their credit histories are used, requiring bureaus to purge data sooner than 7 years, and allowing individuals to remove all performance data from the credit bureau's record. Some lawmakers are even questioning why credit bureaus have any right to collect consumer data in the first place. The question of data surety in all of its various forms is going to be of growing concern moving forward. Awareness is going to increase, driven from the ground up, from constituent to legislator, especially as credit repercussions from the Equifax hack, which already encompasses half the U.S. population, translates into market-driven problems, like getting a loan for anything, as identity fraud begins to impact people and the economy in ways that are presently unimaginable. Because let's face it, that data is gone, and as long as it is used to identify you and provide credit, you are at risk for the rest of your life. Medicare is currently addressing this problem by issuing new insurance cards to Medicare recipients that no longer use Social Security numbers. Eventually, a national ID card may be issued that replaces the Social Security card altogether. There may well be a separate card for credit purposes only. Biometrics and blockchain may play a central role in new security measures. And should another credit crisis strike, on par or worse than 2008, don't be surprised if instead of an economic reset, we first see legislators attempt some kind of credit reset, because of all the data breaches that will be blamed as the cause of markets seizing up. Perhaps we'll see credit scores reset to a mandatory higher number, enabling rapid access to more credit by all consumers, and maybe even some kind of universal basic income as an incentive to ease the transition into a new world of credit and debt. Regardless of what changes actually unfold, one option may simply be to reduce or eliminate all your debt as soon as is reasonably possible, so that those debts are not revalued, strapped to your back, and made to follow you and your family into whatever new paradigm awaits. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.